This episode is brought to you by academyofburlesque.online and the Burlesque 101 course for all bodies with award-winning professional tease, Miss Indigo Blue.
Welcome to the Wash Your Mouth Out podcast, Power, Pleasure, and Parenting. We are stigma-smashing feminist parents creating a new narrative. Put in your earbuds. This is for you only. This is the place to be entertained, empowered, inspired, and feel seen while you're raising small humans.
Wash your mouth out!
We are your hosts,
Moriah Malott
and Madison Young.
Kimberly Seals Allers is an award-winning journalist, author of 5 books, international speaker, strategist, and advocate for maternal and infant health. A former senior editor at Essence and writer at Fortune magazine, Kimberly is a leading commentator on birth, breastfeeding, and motherhood, and the intersection of race, policy, and culture. A frequent contributor at the New York Times and Washington Post, Slate, and others, Kimberly has over 20 years of experience as an international business journalist and Wall Street columnist, which gives her a unique lens to frame communication strategy with an understanding of business and the capital markets. As the director of various on-the-ground community-based projects in several U.S. cities, Kimberly is also deeply rooted in the lived experience of mothers across the socioeconomic spectrum. She brings all of these experiences to bear in her strategic advisement for clients, advocacy efforts, and her vision for a world that supports mothering as valued work. Kimberly was recently named one of the 21 leaders of the 21st century for 2018 by Women's E-News for her media advocacy work. Her 5th book, The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding, was published by St. Martin's Press.
Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
I definitely want to talk about The Big Letdown a lot today, because I'm just obsessed with it. But what other projects do you have going on these days?
Oh, wow. It's always so much going on. I've been working on the Maternal and Child Health Communication Collective. I've been extremely passionate about using improved communication and the way that we talk about these issues to kind of shift the national dialogue, but also help to eliminate health disparities. So I'm currently leading a project that's being funded by the Kellogg Foundation to really organize about 85 national organizations who are working on maternal and child health issues in many different ways for us to create coordinated campaigns and really work together around shifting the discourse. So that's been a great joy of mine. I've been saying for some time that those of us who care about these issues have to work in concert and not just in agreement. And so it's exciting for me to kind of lead those efforts. I've also just been kind of expanding what I'm doing around sharing thoughts online. I have a very busy public speaking schedule, and it's been exciting for me to actually capture some of the presentations and thoughts and ideas that I travel literally the world speaking about, but bringing them to my online platform. So we just relaunched a number of webinars on the Kimberly Seals Allers website. So I'm super excited about that. And I've got another book in my head that's I'm slowly getting out. And, you know, there's always more stuff going on.
Oh, another book. It's brewing in there, huh?
It's brewing. It's been in my head for a while, and I'm working on finding time to get it out. So I'm excited about that.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to see what it is. I know that you have, you were just talking about the webinars. What was the latest webinar that you're working on?
Yeah, the latest one was called Female Fury, kind of understanding the context of anger among women in order to kind of advance a new feminist agenda. I think that there's been a lot of conversation. I actually wrote a piece in the Washington Post about this around anger being this pivotal moment for women right now as a political tool, but really not really looking at the nuances of anger among mothers, where it is more of a divisive tool. And also something that we don't talk about because motherhood is often framed as lovely and beautiful and, you know, the happiest time of your life. And so anger has been a complex nuance of the motherhood experience, which I think that we need to bring to the fore. And we want to, for me, I always want to make sure that whatever we're talking about in the broader kind of women's movement and feminist movement, that we're thinking about how these issues play out for mothers, which, you know, hasn't traditionally been a part of the feminist agenda, but it's incredibly important for it to do so now. So I'm, you know, that one was well received. We had such a good conversation. And I was really pleased with the content that I developed. So yeah, I encourage everyone to please check it out.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to bring that up again a little bit later in our call for sure. But yeah, we definitely want to talk about the big letdown.
So in the big letdown, you said mothers will be better served when feminism as a movement accepts that breastfeeding is not a choice. Breastfeeding is a reproductive right. So I completely agree. And yes. Yet both of these terms are used interchangeably in the context of abortion politics. Can you elaborate on your distinction between these words here for us?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are a couple of things. When we, first of all, when we talk about reproductive rights, which has traditionally been framed around the right not to get pregnant, very important. The right to end an unwanted pregnancy, also very important. But we need to include the right to also, you know, use your reproductive organs and, in my work, also feed what your reproductive organs produced, right? And so if we don't develop a more broader kind of definition of what reproductive rights are, we're never going to build a broad-based feminist movement or women's movement that doesn't include all the roles that a woman will play in her life. So we're only framing it around one end of not using reproductive organs and then nothing for those who choose to do so, then that is not really a women's movement. It's leaving so many women behind. And what we find is, you know, then on the other side of actually using your reproductive organs, there's nothing for you, but really the big letdown, because we haven't worked as hard on the other side of that. And so that's why we really need to start reframing what's going on in birth and breastfeeding as also a reproductive right. And include that in this conversation that I feel many of us are gearing up, feeling that we're going to have to gear up to fight for right about now and advocate for some protections that we want to make sure that we're protecting women throughout their life continuum and all the roles that they play in the reproductive cycle and not just at the very beginning. So that's critically important. And then the other part of it is really just thinking about this language of choice, which has been very much a language around, you know, the abortion conversation and really recognizing that it becomes a silencing factor when we're talking about birth and breastfeeding. So, you know, first of all, as I often say, choices are within choices, right? Is breastfeeding really a choice for a woman who has to go back to work in 5 days, right? And we know that in this country, the only industrialized nation without a federal paid leave, that 25% of women are going back to work after 10 days, which is just ridiculous and unconscionable and a national disgrace. And so within that context, what is really a choice for you? Within the choices that you have. And so I always talk about choices within choices and that we really need to expand this language because when someone says it's a choice, it's become a very individualized and personal discussion, which means that I can't really talk to you about it. I can't really discuss how choices are within choices. I can't discuss how choices affect others and public health and policy. And so we really need to move some of this beyond this polarized language of choice so that we can actually talk about it and really understand the nuance of choice and not that not everybody has the same choices. That's just the truth.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
That's incredible. So So it refers quite a bit to then also creating policies that help to support women in breastfeeding, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, so without the policies, things become impossible. You know, sure, I would love to breastfeed and I go back to work, but now I have to kind of fight with my employer to see if they're implementing the, you know, the policy that exists around break time and pumping, you know, pumping rooms. And, you know, it's choices within choices, which are being affected by policies, which are being affected by, you know, other factors that are beyond our individual control. So to focus on the individual decision without looking at how those decisions can be impeded or supported by policy, by cultural norms, et cetera, is really short-sighted and detrimental to women, in my opinion.
It reminds me of this idea, you know, where we have a tax on menstrual products.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really that we need, in order to really fully have our reproductive rights, we need to be supported by policy in being able to have a body, you know, like being able to, yes, to exist in a working body. That needs to be supported as part of our politics. There's so much around this topic in your book. Would you like to share a passage from The Big Letdown for our listeners?
Sure, I would love to. One of the things that I like to talk about, and since we're kind of in the space of talking about feminism, you know, really to help people understand, because to be honest, I took a lot of heat, not just from the title of the book, but this idea that we can't have a critical analysis of feminism. You know, I consider myself a feminist or more of a womanist as we kind of broaden that context. But, you know, we have to acknowledge the unintended consequences around, you know, the way feminism and certainly first wave and second wave, you know, didn't really support mothering as valued work. And that while we were doing the very important fight to be viewed as equal to men, that we forgot to fight for the things that make us uniquely women, which include birth and breastfeeding. And we just have to accept that as an unintended consequence that we have an opportunity to fix and change and rewrite that narrative. So I talk a little bit about that and just why breastfeeding is a feminist issue. And I'd love to just read that section from the chapter on the feminist fallacy. So here's what I wrote. The ultimate connection between breastfeeding and feminism is that in a truly equitable society, women will have the capacity to pursue both their productive and reproductive work without penalty. In that vein, breastfeeding becomes the perfect lens to see the misogyny of our culture as it impacts women. Women are harassed and shamed and illegally evicted from public spaces for breastfeeding. Women are threatened with losing custody of their children for breastfeeding for, quote unquote, too long. Women are ridiculed and bullied for trying to pump milk at work. Women are described as freak shows for breastfeeding twins or tandem feeding. Women are called names for breastfeeding. Women are told they are sexually abusing their children for breastfeeding. Women are told they're not allowed to keep breast milk in communal fridges because it's viewed as a bodily secretion and not as food. Women are bullied into stopping breastfeeding because breasts are the sexual objects of men. Women are told that it is obscene to breastfeed in front of other people's children or other people's husbands. Women are told their bodies are too fat or too saggy or too veiny to be exposed while breastfeeding. Women are instructed to throw blankets over themselves and their babies if they wish to breastfeed outside the home. The list goes on. This is not the result of some peculiar sensitivity toward babies and small children eating. This does not happen with bottle feeding. This is unique to breastfeeding, and it is about policing women's bodies and their lives. You know, exactly the kinds of things feminists used to get riled up about. The fact that women are harassed and shamed for doing something that women's bodies do as a routine part of bearing children is a severe societal flaw that should trouble all feminists. And so for me, you know, this idea about breastfeeding being a feminist issue is really not about whether you breastfed or not, or whether you choose to breastfeed or not. It is about recognizing that when women are being policed about their bodies, shamed about their bodies, that we all should be up in arms. And we all should fight for women to do what they want to do with their bodies, even including breastfeeding without shame, without, you know, scorn, and also with policy support and societal support. That's what I had to say about that.
Wow.
At least one part of it.
Thank you so much for reading that. You know, one of the, in the beginning of the book is this amazing couple of chapters that are so heavily and well researched and pretty much mind blowing about how we have come to be where we are at with breastfeeding and formula feeding in terms of capitalism's capitalism and big businesses influence on the way that women see their bodies and their ability to feel confident in their bodies. And I think that that has been, you know, we've talked about that with fashion and makeup and high heels and all of this stuff. But this is, that area is really such an amazing lens. So I really just want to, you know, again, recommend people taking a deep dive into a book that's really going to kind of blow your mind on all of those areas.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I think that, you know, there are the obvious ways that we know that our bodies are co-opted by commercial interests and, you know, but there are the ones that become less obvious to us because they've been kind of mingled and crowded and kind of ensconced in other issues such as choice, you know, such as just individualized nation, you know, notion, as opposed to recognizing that actually there's a commercial interest in how we feed our children. And there's a, you know, $70 billion global industry that benefits from us not using our bodies to feed our children. And also when we look at breast milk for really what it is, which is preventative medicine and the earliest possible health intervention for any of us, right? It's our first food. It's our first opportunity to be affected by what we eat. And so when we also consider that the idea, I mean, all that we're learning about how our earliest foods shape our health trajectory, even what's happening to us in utero shapes our health trajectory, that this is significant. And so really, the pharmaceutical companies have a vested interest in all of us being, you know, less healthier throughout our lives, because that means we are more likely to need drugs and other things when we kind of start our life in a less healthier state. So, you know, the connection between their interest in priming us for a less healthier trajectory and our children, and the fact that we actually create the most healthiest first food there is something that we all should consider as women. And that, you know, we're being separated from our biological norm. Obviously it has not become maintained as the cultural norm, but that's work that we can do, and at least to advocate for that and to make sure we have the policies in place to support that.
Absolutely.
You talk a lot in the big letdown about the fallacy of the breast pump liberating women. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit more to this idea?
Yeah, I think that's so important. I think that throughout time, we've looked at things to be the, you know, our quote unquote liberation. At one point, it was formula, right? It was going to liberate us from the, you know, the tyranny of motherhood or whatever that may be. And that this, that, that the pump would later become, you know, kind of the best of both worlds. And while, because we live in a country that does not offer the policy support in terms of paid leave, what has happened is that the pump has become really a, you know, another second rate substitute. And I say that because the ability to pump is incredibly important, and we do need more employers making sure that is a possibility and availability for mothers. But we don't want the pump to distract us from losing sight of what we truly deserve, which is time to mother. And so I often say that we don't want to be kind of led astray by these nice rooms with some IKEA furniture, when what we really deserve is not, you know, an outlet and a fridge, but actually time to mother, for mothers who want to do that paid time to mother. And so once we can get mothering valued as important work, so that everyone who actually wants to continue feeding their baby without being forced to go back to work before they're ready can have that option, then we will really be
that will really be our liberation, not the idea that machines are replacing us. The other thing that is really important to note is that this separation of women from our bodies and the milk that we produce, the product we produce, is also very dangerous. So, you know, breast milk itself is very valuable. If you, you know, it takes a lot of work to get it from your body. If you try to purchase it, it can be extremely expensive. And so the milk that the object that we produce, the product we produce, is valued, but us actually giving it to our babies directly by ourselves is not valued. Mm. So this separation of mothers and their product is very dangerous. When once separated from us, highly valuable, but for us to, you know, while in us and for us to give it directly, not so much. And so this is this, you know, kind of economics of our milk versus our mothering that really bears more thoughtful consideration from women, so that we don't kind of just say, okay, well, I can remove the product and kind of detach that from the nurturing and everything else that comes from it. And so I just want people to be aware of these broader issues, because it can be boiled down to a very simplistic thing. Well, you know, you can't breastfeed, but here's your pump. And that's really not the end all be all for what we truly deserve.
Yeah, that's not, you know, now that we have laws about everybody needing to have, you know, everybody gets to have a place to pump, and you can definitely take your employer through some legal hurdles in order to make sure that that happens. Now we've kind of got that going, but that, you know, is not ultimately what everybody needs. And we have so much more policy to do to make sure that, you know, obviously that not everybody is going to want to stay away from work. Not everybody is going to want to breastfeed, but for those who want to, again, back with that word choice or reproductive rights, you know, yes, you have a choice, but it's also extremely important that, that these rights are upheld, the right to be in your body, the right to be present with the work that your body is doing, to have the time and the space to do that, the right to parent your child in the way that, you know, that you feel is right for you. Very important.
Very important.
So, you know, one of the major healthcare disparities for Black women is the lack of access to post-hospital breastfeeding support. And I'm a lactation counselor. I have a close friend who is like a sister to me, who lived at one point in what you call in your book a first food desert. So sort of looking at the idea of food deserts for lower income and folks of color, you know, where access to healthy food is nearly impossible within certain zip codes. And so you're saying a first food desert, first food being milk, right? And so she was in one of these first food deserts where there's little cultural or service-based lactation support for Black women. And I had to send her multiple zip codes. Somebody is screaming. I had to send her. This is a mom podcast. No, this is a parenting podcast, and we're going to have some screaming children sometimes. So I had to send her multiple zip codes in Virginia out of her way to access any kind of lactation support. And most lactation professionals I know in the states surrounding me are white. And those of us that do travel to support families don't want to travel very far. And so those of us that live in a quote-unquote white neighborhoods and don't want to travel very far, you know, we are not serving people who need us the most. And quite frankly, you know, I know a lot of Black women who would prefer to be served by Black lactation consultants and support. So I'm just wondering, have you come across any solutions happening in this country to bring that first milk to these first food deserts?
Yes. In fact, I, you know, have been creating those types of programs and interventions, and I'm real excited about the progress we've been making. First, you know, I think it's really, really too important that we make the connection between the things that we've already discussed and what you're asking me right now, because, again, because breastfeeding has historically been viewed around choice and a highly individualized conversation, people haven't looked at the context of your environment as a determining factor, right? So in this country, whether you succeed or fail in breastfeeding is completely up to you. I mean, that's the language, right? You're responsible for seeking help. You're responsible mm-hmm. for that. And for me, that didn't make sense. And I think one of the eye-opening moments in the trajectory of my work was when I was actually a food and community fellow and with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy a few years ago. And just a quick backstory, they had come to New York for an informational session. I had didn't know what it was about. Went with a friend who invited me because it was free wines. I was like, okay, I'm there. And we went, and it was really interesting to see this food fellowship talking about all of these sustainable agriculture issues and food systems issues and food deserts and, you know, really having these complex conversations. And I end up saying to someone, you know, who's a director or one of the admissions folks, like, you know, hey, this is great that you have a food fellowship, but what about the first food? And I'm sure that in the same communities where people are struggling to get a banana, that those infants aren't receiving their healthiest food either. And, you know, they encouraged me to apply, and I did. And I was the first person to be accepted into this food fellowship talking about breastfeeding as a food systems issue. And this was really, really important because in our food world, we've acknowledged that to tell people to eat well and exercise without checking in to see if they could easily access healthy fruits and vegetables or have a safe place to exercise was kind of foolish, right? And so now the USDA documents the millions of Americans who are living in literal food deserts. So on the breastfeeding side, for me, it was like, well, how do we tell women you should breastfeed, particularly those who may live in low-income or vulnerable communities or marginalized areas, without checking in to see if they have the actual resources and support to do so? It was very much the way that we could accept that now within our kind of broader food conversation. But when it came to infants, and because they have to rely on the mother, we didn't have the same kind of contextual acceptance. And so I spent my time in that fellowship, you know, kind of building this body of language and writings and research around how we can better understand the community influence. And that work led the Kellogg Foundation to, you know, fund me to do some really great exploratory projects in the Southeast, where I worked in New Orleans, Jackson, Mississippi, Birmingham, literally knocking on doors to understand what was the contextual environment that we needed to better understand in order to support these women. And some of it, like you said, is very simple. Like, there are great places where La Leche League meetings exist, and there are many places they absolutely do not. Many of those being Black and Brown communities. And that's something that La Leche League has been working directly to influence. So I want to just give them that due credit. But at the time, it was huge disparities on where there was support. This is obviously also affected by stereotypes around who breastfeeds and who doesn't. For me, this is also very connected to an idea of who was considered a good mother and who was not. And breastfeeding has long been associated with quote unquote good mothering. And Black women have been viewed as perfectly capable and desirable for taking care of other people's children, but somehow viewed as incapable of taking care of our own children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a dangerous lie and stereotype that developed often through our media, often through our television shows, et cetera, et cetera. So all these things have perpetuated this idea that these people don't really need help, or it's not worth it to help them because they're not going to do it. But what we found was that they actually wanted to do it, and they had no idea that they were not being given information. And it still breaks my heart in the many places that I travel to hear Black women who have not received the very basic information about breastfeeding, the very basic information, also about childbirth. And so we really have to look at these disparities in terms of resources, the disparities in terms of who receives information, who is considered worthy of breastfeeding support and help.
And even from the lactation consultant side, I often, you know, share that obviously lactation consultants, particularly those in hospital environments, are very overworked. Many of them, you know, there needs to be more of them in hospitals, and that's something we have to work on. But what happens when that lactation consultant at the hospital, whose own time is strapped, who is also working within the healthcare system, now is faced with two doors, right? Door number one, a white woman who wants to breastfeed and is excited to get going. Door number two, a Black woman, maybe a young Black woman who says she's tried it, but not really sure, right? And she has to make a decision. And so what's going to happen in that scenario? Is she going to go to door number one, where she knows that that woman is actually going to breastfeed and she can walk out by checking a box that said this mother left exclusively breastfeeding? Mm. Or is she going to door number two? And the question is, who really needs her help more, right?
Wow.
So clearly, yeah. You know, even in certain settings, lactation consultants themselves are forced to make decisions, and sometimes their decision making continues to further disparities. And so it's complex. But what we did learn, and in addition to me identifying the concept and pioneering the concept of First Fruit Deserts, and I would love everyone to check out the infographic, the video that's on YouTube on First Fruit Deserts to fully understand what we found in that work. We also began to implement solutions in our First Fruit Friendly Community work, which was in Detroit and Philadelphia, where we literally decided that the community could save itself, and that if we wanted an answer to what we could do, my mantra is in every presentation, whatever the question, the answers in the community, that it was not up to us to think about our quote unquote evidence-based research or our great ideas, but actually the community was a place that we can go to for solutions. And so we literally hired and recruited women, mothers from the community, to come up with solutions. And then we paid them in an internship to implement them. And we allowed the community to actually solve these problems. And so whenever people are asking me anything around these issues, like from why can't I get anyone to come to my support group to what can we do? My answer is always, did you ask the community? Because we continually and detrimentally view them as a place that we go to fix and change, but we don't view the community as a source of solutions. And I am telling you and everyone who will listen that they can save themselves if we ask them and help them and give them the resources they need to do so. So that's what we learned. And it's been phenomenal.
Absolutely. That's like, you know, that just is such an example of the white savior complex. Mm-hmm. I hear, you know, nonstop lactation professionals around me talk about what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? How do we fix this? How do we fix this? And you're right. Nobody, you know, people rarely go and ask members of the community. It's a huge problem.
Yes.
So the YouTube video is, if people search First Food Deserts, will they be able to pull that up?
Yes, they okay. should find it by First Food Deserts, and it's on my page, one of them. Let me clarify that. Better check myself. But yeah, it's called First Food Deserts, and what is the First Food Desert? Is the actual name of the video. And it really kind of walks through what we learned. And there were some stark commonalities, in all of these communities that were, you know, that couldn't just be thrown up to chance. We really wanted to show, like, this is a thing, the way we understand food deserts, and that people literally don't have support, and therefore the health outcomes are impacted. The same thing is happening for infants who need to rely on their mothers to receive their most nutritious food.
What does that ideal support and resources look like for you? Like, if we were able to morph things right now, mm-hmm. what resources and support would you like to see in place?
Well, certainly the first thing is paid leave. And, you know, we've seen employers step up to fill in the gap. But when you think about what's happening with hourly workers, you know, mm-hmm. people still work in certain industries like manufacturing, it's still not a level playing field. So we need to get paid leave for all, so that everyone who wants to or chooses to you know, spend time doing their mothering work can be supported to do so. So that's the first thing for everybody. We know that's not the end all be all, but it is really important. The next thing would really be about, you know, a cultural shift in valuing mothering as important work so women can do that work without stigma. This idea, and I talked about this around postpartum depression, this idea that motherhood is not work makes women feel incredibly pressured to be quote unquote productive in the early days after motherhood, as if the mothering work is not important, right? And that leads to stress, that leads to this thing that we feel about who we have become after motherhood. So I talked about that. Also, I wrote this piece around Women's History Month because I was deeply concerned that Women's History Month is all about celebrating our secular accomplishments, which is important in the ways that we have bested men, et cetera, and been pioneers, but doesn't ever include mothering as important work. And we can't continue to do that. So, you know, kind of part of the work is us and the work that we need to do as women to value mothering. On a cultural level, you know, there are some really specific things that we need to do, particularly to make sure that we lift up those who have been most burdened. So first of all, centering those who have been most burdened. If you look at what's going on with Black maternal mortality, Black breastfeeding rates, Black infant mortality, it is clear that Black women and Black babies are faring the worst in this country. And so we need to center them in any solution that we're looking to create. And that includes listening to them and understanding the context of their experience. One of the things that I've been talking about, which is, you know, probably the most second important thing in all my presentations, is separating the act from the experience, right? And so we often focus on the act of breastfeeding. So a lactation consultant is talking about the latch, very important. But if you actually ask women what often trips them up in breastfeeding, it's really not the latch, which you can get help with. It's, I didn't have a support network. I had to go back to work. I didn't know people who looked like me did this. There are these other things around the experience of breastfeeding. Uh-huh. I was afraid of being kicked out of, you know, the restaurant. So I don't go, I need to breastfeed in public. I need to get out of my house. So it's the experience, and we have to focus on that. Also with birth, yes, it is important. I've been talking about this a lot on social media this week. It is important that in our childbirth education programs that we teach women how to push and breathe and deal with the act of birth. But if we are not preparing Black and brown women, low-income women, immigrant women for the experience of birth in a system that we know disrespects them, right? Mm-hmm. In a system that we know ignores them and is unfortunately killing Black women in particular at a disproportionate rate, then what are we doing? What are we doing? And so this idea that we have to really get rooted in the experience is critical to how we kind of change things. And that experience is different. And that's the thing. There is no one size fits all. The experience of the women I worked with in Detroit was slightly different for the experience I worked with in Philadelphia, and very different from the experience of women that, you know, live here in New York City where I live. So it's really about accepting that all of these things are going to have to be community centered so that we can really create something that's effective.
Right. So holistic support, mm-hmm. not just physical, but also an emphasis on the experience and the emotional support that we actually need to get there.
Absolutely. And looking at the social stressors, we opened the first lactation lounge in Detroit, which we call the Mother's Room. But the Mother's Room, all it is, while it is a place to breastfeed and pump, is also a place where we have, you know, career workshops, and we try to bring in folks who may be hiring. And we also talk about mothers in general and their well-being and self-care. So if we're not looking at all these issues, then we're not going to move the needle in terms of birth outcomes or breastfeeding outcomes, because stress is a, you know, is a key factor in impacting birth outcomes. And we know that stress will literally impact your letdown reflex. It will not allow you to breastfeed for any meaningful duration. So for me, telling stressed out women to breastfeed feels cruel. And so we always try to make sure we're doing something to address social stress or something, even if we're just speaking to it, to create space for the dialogue to come up. But if we're acting like these things can happen in isolation and without context to what's going on in their lives in a broader way, then we're not going to get there.
Yeah, I'm here in Philly right now, and we have an organization called Mom Mobile. Mm-hmm. Really, it's part of a broader organization that specifically serves Black and Brown populations in the Northeast area. And, you know, and lactation professionals drive these cars around, and they come to do home visits and support breastfeeding. But, and, you know, as much as I absolutely love that, when I think about it really deeply, I remember it's not that different from that same hospital scenario where there's a lack of time to visit everybody. And it's sort of like the hamster wheel of breastfeeding support. It's like we just mm-hmm. go from one to the other to the other. And there's so much that we're missing, both in terms of focusing energy on what you said in the beginning, which is that, you know, that time to be stress-free, that, you know, not stress-free, but to not have so much stress on getting back to work, all kinds of stresses. And, you know, it's hard to support somebody in a short period of time to see where they're at with stress and their social support and right. people around them and making sure that they have like a community group to go to surrounding parenting, et cetera. That stuff is so important.
It is so important. I think what we're finding, I mean, first of all, from a communication perspective, right, it's like, well, I mean, there are ways that we can learn to communicate better, that we can get a lot more information from people. But I think that, for example, sometimes it depends on who's asking the questions and how we're asking mm-hmm. the questions. So there are ways to kind of understand these things in a very simple way. But to your point around, you know, what's happening is almost as if the solutions are reflective of the women and the problem, right? So just the same way that women are forced to solve it for themselves, creating a patchwork, right? So you hear these stories about women who are trying to put together some sort of paid leave by holding on their vacation days mm-hmm. and patching together their sick days and trying to add that week between Christmas and New Year's when nobody works. It's like, it's crazy. And so we see the way that women have to deal with, their maternity care and their maternity leave is similar in the way that we're patching together these solutions, right? That, you know, that are trying to fill in the gaps where the system has failed women. Right. And so we're all trying to kind of fill in these gaps because the system continues to fail mothers and women in general and mothers in particular. And so if we could just also make sure that we're pushing just as hard to collectively fill in these gaps, then, you know, there would be less need for the patchwork and the little things that, you know, are meaningful, but, you know, may not be able to fully address, you know?
Yes.
For the birth of my second kiddo, I went to a birthing center with midwives. And I think that the experience for me was so very different because the midwives just had more space for me to cry, for me to talk about my emotions, for me to experience support and community. And it felt much more holistic than with my first kiddo. I was birthing at a hospital, and I felt that hamster wheel kind of experience of like, go in, talk about the physical bits, get out, we don't have enough time to spend. And I think there needs to be more spaces where we can just, where we are able to connect. And I think that's so beautiful. The mother room, is that what you said?
The mother's room, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The mother's room. You know, I mean, just places even to gather and not feel alone in our experience. That isolation seems so key and so critical.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, I think also right now, I believe social media is helping on both sides, right, to also increase the visibility of birth. I've seen more babies coming out of vaginas on Instagram.
Right. I know. Every time I open my feed, I love it.
I love it. I mean, at first I was like, okay, all right, well, here we are. And that's an umbilical cord. Wonderful. So I think a lot of, you know, social media is helping. And then, you know, people are individually, and I think collectively, kind of eschewing some of this kind of sanitized version of motherhood. And now we're showing our stretch marks and we're showing our actual bodies and we're creating these spaces, which I hope can help, you know, in our own feed lines. I do believe we're at a great moment. Not just around how we're rewriting the narrative about motherhood, the way that we, I don't know if it's just me who's feeling like we have to get out our signs again real soon. You know, we know our reproductive right protections are being challenged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, this is a great time for us to, one, making sure that that the picture of motherhood is fair and accurate and inclusive. And then also like the fight for motherhood, the fight for reproductive rights is fair and inclusive and reflective and includes all women. And so I feel like we're at a amazing pivotal point in our history where we have the power to do something amazing, you know?
Wow, what an interview. But it's time for a sponsor break. I was just reminded of that by what Kimberly was saying about stretch marks and about liberation. You, yes you, can create your own burlesque act in the comfort of your own home with Burlesque 101 class at academyofburlesque.online with Miss Indigo Blue. It used to be that you could only take these classes at the famous Academy of Burlesque in Seattle. I took the course. It was an amazing creative outlet for me. If you're a parent, you probably could use some inspiration for getting your sexiness mojo back. And this class was absolutely for all bodies, all gender expressions. You don't have to have any dance experience. And Indigo is the funniest, most engaging teacher that you will ever meet. She's really great at helping all of us feel comfortable and hot in our own skin, which is really great for me because my skin looks a little different after kids and I want to love it more and work it. There are 3 levels of teaching support and our listeners get a super special $50 off the signature, $60 off deluxe, or $120 off the VIP version of the class with the code SOAP, S-O-A-P, at checkout. That's academyofburlesque.online. Back to our show.
You've written in the book and said here that we need to consider mothering real work.
Mm-hmm.
What will it mean and what will it look like to conceptualize mothering as real work? And what do you think that the political steps are for us to get there?
Yeah, that's such a great question. You know, I think the valuing of mothering as real work has to start with mothers themselves, has to start with women themselves. And I think what has happened is that because of this kind of feminist history of this idea of mothering being beneath us and kind of limiting, and we don't want to be tethered to a child as kind of not what modern motherhood is about, we have to reframe that now, because that has kind of led to, and I don't subscribe that there actually are mommy wars, but there are, you know, this conflict between working moms and stay-at-home moms, and, you know, all these other things is because the work that we're doing in the home is not valued as same as the work that can be done outside the home. And that is rooted in you don't get paid for it. And so if you don't get paid for it, it's not work, right? So, you know, I mean, and so I often say it's really crazy that I could pay somebody else to take care of my kid, but no one will pay me to take care of my kid, right?
Right.
So it doesn't make sense. And so it's work for the person that I hire to do it, but it's not work for me. And so, you know, these kind of distinctions and valuations that unfortunately in our society have been made around who gets paid for what is critical. So then that's where the paid leave part comes in. And certainly I want to nod that many states are making great inroads on this. And we want to try to lift up those states, and, you know, maybe nothing will happen on the federal level in this administration.
But, you know, certainly on the state level, we are seeing some innovative programs and some models that other states can look to. So I just want to put that out there for those who are, you know, don't lose all hope, see what your state is doing and advocate on a state level. So, but I think, you know, that part is the first part of valuing mothering's important work. And then there's the work we have to do as women to change that conversation within ourselves so right. that we are not making these lines, that we are not, you know, looking at a mother or someone who's mothering and is their work and be like, what do you do all day? And, you know, the ways that it comes out in our comments. And so how do we lift up that amongst women so that that can be amplified? And then, you know, so we don't have a Women's History Month that doesn't talk about mothering as important work and that mothers are relegated to one day with overpriced brunch, you know, which overpriced brunch. Versus being an integral part of women's history in this country. Like, that's a problem. And so a lot of that is cultural. And I think that we can lead that.
I think that, that's exactly, you know, you kind of just answered one of the things that we wanted to ask you, which was, you know, like, how do we kind of make an internal shift? How do we make an internal shift while we're kind of slowly politically trying to shift right. things toward mothering as the real work. But I think that it sounds like one of the things you're saying is around sort of a larger kind of country community gathering as part of a month, as part of a larger discussion on Mother's Day that's not so feely-feely all, you know, roses and chocolates. And I wrote an article actually about kind of why I hate Mother's Day last year, but with this basically exactly what you're saying, which is I hate Mother's Day because we're not talking about what's really happening, what the real experience is of mothering, the lack of cultural appreciation for the work, is so troubling to me.
It should be troubling to all of us. It is troubling. And, you know, again, this is the power for us to shift things. And I think when we can, you know, use our own platforms and to your point, your writings and things like that to help people think about things differently. And this is why I'm so proud of the Big Letdown. It was a lot of work, but I'm most proud when people say, I never thought of it that way. Right. And so that's what we have to do is help people see it a different way and to really challenge the things that we've been told, as I say, we've been told and sold about women and from our bodies to our role as mothers and all of it. And when we do that, you know, then we're going to have this opportunity to really blow it wide open, to really push for the things that we need from each other and the things that we can demand from our governments and from our policymakers, right? And so that's going to really help us move things forward.
It really is the new feminist agenda. Is that a phrase that you coined?
You know, I don't know. I've seen a lot of crazy phrases. It is my thing, you know. Like, I still talk about my husband, which is one of my favorite words.
Your husband?
Yeah. I don't know if you saw my tweet about my Uberus, which it's been retweeted
yes,
like 10,000 times, which I, for those listening, I have an Uber driver who came from my uterus, who is my daughter. And ever since she got her license, her job is to be my Uber driver. And I call her my Uber from my uterus, which is Uberus for short. And I tweeted about my Uberus driving me around and everybody was tickled. So I do make up words. But
I love that.
Yeah.
Love
but that. I think that's important in terms of, you know, how do we create language? I mean, creating language around things is really important, particularly for me. I'm a word person and, you know, I come to this work from as a journalist. Like the language of it all is very important to me. And I think that when we think about having an agenda, and, you know, that sounds extremely important, right? And that means we're going to get something done and there's an intention. And so I think that, you know, these words that we're using are important for framing what we want and what we expect to get from the other side.
I think it's very important to just create new language in order to get new things done. So
absolutely.
I'm really glad that you're coming up with new words. And I just want to throw it out there for folks listening, especially college professors, that I really think that the big letdown needs to be, in order to make all these changes happening, to make these changes happen, we need the big letdown to be on the syllabi for Women's Studies 101 classes, because the entire issue of how feminism and mothering are, you know, interrelated, have been at odds, one has not supported the other, is often just not present at all when people are first learning about what it is to be a woman in the world.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And I'm very grateful for the universities and schools that have had me and have included the big letdown on their syllabi for women's studies. I agree. It's really important. And the other thing that's so important about this is, like, what has happened is that you don't care about this until you become a mother. And then you're too exhausted to do anything about it, right?
That's right. Yes.
You're basically exactly. Just trying to get a shower in, you know, if you're lucky, and that feels like a win. And so we really need to have people thinking about these issues, you know, before they become mothers, and really framing it as something that's important to all women. First of all, you know, statistically, over 80% of women will become mothers at some point in their lifetime. But we have to, again, end the separation between women who are mothers and women who are not mothers, right? And that we're all in this together. And yes, getting women who at a younger place, who actually have more energy than we do, but also need to be thinking about these issues, to think of it as not a thing about mothers. No, it's a women's issue, because you are still a woman when you become a mother. It's just you're adding another role to that. And again, you know, framing women's issues all around not using reproductive organs, and nothing around how we live and breathe and exist within our society, when you do take on that role, is a huge disservice and has greatly contributed to the big letdown that, you know, all women face once they do come onto the other side. And so we really have to be having these conversations much earlier. So I'm grateful, and certainly are welcome to more women's studies groups having the big letdown as a book to discuss, for me to talk about it either or, because it is so critical.
Because it needs to be part of the original forming of people's feminism. Mm-hmm. It can't be left out until, you know, later in life or three classes down the line. It needs to be part of that first learning about who we are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I've seen you talking about feminist rage. And I wanted to know, where have you found effective use for feminist rage? And also, how and where, if anywhere, has this rage intersected with feminist parenting for you? You know, with the understanding that the expression of rage is a really racially charged issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I was just thinking about rage in terms of expression of feminist rage. And, you know, these days the culture of parenting is very, very super nicey, touchy-feely. Nobody has any, there should be no rage. And you should not express rage in front of your children and all of this stuff. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, or just anything you want to talk about with feminist rage.
Yes. I mean, I have a lot to say about feminist rage, and I would, you know, encourage everyone who's listening to check out the webinar where I really explored these issues and really broke them down in ways that I think many people hadn't thought about before. But I think the biggest thing that we have to think about is feminists. I mean, rage has always had a role in feminist history. Like, we got angry and we got results. Like, that's real. And that's how we were able to get a lot done. But it also has been a tool for silencing women who are told not to be angry, right? So there's this always been this complexity between angry women and then nice ladies, you know, and this, like, you know, if you're a nice lady, then you don't get angry. And you know, this whole thing, there's always been this complexity around anger and then, you know, being a quote unquote lady. And so how do we really reconcile that, when in fact, motherhood is enraging. Not the, again, not the act of motherhood, but the experience of motherhood when you being forced to go back to work after 10 days, when childcare is unaffordable or low quality, you know, when you don't have supportive policies at work, when there's no kind of space for saying I have to leave work because of my kid, you know, that's what makes mothering so enraging, the isolation that we were just talking about. And so what happens when women are in a space that is completely anger, you know, angrified, right? And angering, but aren't allowed to express that, you know, and that is a suppression of women that we all need to be concerned about. For me, it also plays into postpartum depression in terms of having this feeling that is not validated by the world, because the world is saying you should be happy and this is a blessing, but you're angry. And, you know, some of that could be hormonal, but some of that could be very much related to the culture that doesn't allow you to be fully expressed around who you are. And so we really want to acknowledge that. And I think even for those of us, you know, who may work in breastfeeding or lactation consulting or just around these issues, like, you know, we're uncomfortable with the anger. We're uncomfortable with it because we want everybody to be happy. But we have to start dealing with our own discomfort with rage so that we can create space for women to authentically talk about whatever it is they're experiencing. And I don't mean the blues, I mean rage, which is very, very real. And so we have to kind of allow that to be part of what we talked about is happening on social media. Yes, we need to show our stretch marks, but we can also show the ways that we're angry and not really about motherhood. It was not that we're angry necessarily at our kids per se, but we're angry at the system that doesn't allow us to spend the time that we want to. We're angry at the fact that, you know, many of us have chosen to give up our careers really because we didn't see another way to make mothering work for our family, or the fact that childcare is so expensive, it didn't make sense for both parents to continue working. Like, all of these things can easily make you angry. And so we have to create space to talk about that. And so I think that is part of it, is for us to be comfortable with it as women, creating space for it, and also to acknowledge that it does exist within the motherhood experience. And it is also a documented medical part of postpartum depression. Like, postpartum depression, yes, is not just about being sad, right? And then, you know, you're like, I'm not sad, I'm just angry, which postpartum rage is part of those, is part of that spectrum of PPD that we also need to talk about.
You're right. And I teach a course that's around sleep and breastfeeding for family professionals, doulas, and lactation counselors. And when it's true, even though I think I do a great job at talking about postpartum mood challenges, I very rarely talk about that rage. And when I'm just hearing you talk about it, all of these images and sounds flood back to me from the many women that I've worked with. It's so real. It's so present for so many folks. And it's not just, you know, a mental health issue. It comes from a place of very real challenges.
Yeah, it's very real. And lack of support. I mean, we live in one of the few countries as well where there's no postpartum support as a standard part of care, right? In most other places, you have a baby and someone's going to show up at your house in 2 or 3 days to check on you. That just does not exist here, you know, as standard practice from our model of care. And so all of these things, or, you know, this vacuous hole that mothers are left in, all of it can, you know, it can make anyone angry, and rightfully so. And that's what we have to say. And, you know, my thing is, how do we turn the anger into action, right? Like, let's not just be angry or turning it against each other, because now we come angry with those who may have privilege and other options that we did not have. And so I turn my anger toward the mother who can stay at home when I did not have that choice, right? Versus turning my anger toward the system that doesn't allow both of us to have the same options, right? And so that's what, you know, I ultimately talk about in Female Fury in the webinar, is how do we turn the anger into action? And instead of pointing it at each other, what is it that we can actually do with this in a productive way, both around policy and around shifting culture?
Wow, that is so profound about you know, that that's one of the reasons why we turn on each other. I'm thinking about what you said recently about how social media has been really effective at helping, you know, even when folks can't come together in an actual group, how moms can kind of come together through social media. And I feel like we should start a hashtag mom rage just so that, you know, that there's a place to talk about what's enraging you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And for us to be okay with that. Right. And I think those hashtags are extremely important for understanding, you know, for people to have outlets to express themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the webinar, Female Fury and the New Feminist Agenda, you recently did that. Is it recorded where people can access it, or are you doing it again, or how can people listen to that?
Yeah, it has been recorded and it is available for viewing on KimberlySealsAllers.com. Just go to events and online events and you'll see the tab for webinar events and it will be there with the others at the top of the page.
Cool. Thank you.
And there was one thing I wanted to share that I forgot to mention at the beginning.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the projects I'm super excited about that I've been working on is we've been developing an app, which is called Earth, IRTH. It's the word birth, but we dropped the B for bias. And one of the things that we know is that not all women experience the same place in the same way. I know in my personal experience, when I had my first child, I was just finishing up grad school at Columbia. And at that time, most of my girlfriends who had babies were white. And they told me all the great hospitals to go to in New York City, the New York City area. And I took them up on their recommendation and went there and left traumatized, right? Because at the time I was not married and having still just finished up my master's, I was still on student insurance. And so, you know, I was an unmarried black woman with basic insurance and I was treated that way. And for many years afterwards, we all said, were you at the same place that I was? And I was like, yes, I was. But people aren't treated the same place in the same way. And we know this is very much this unconscious bias and the people's identity being impacting their care is very much connected to what we're learning about the Black maternal mortality crisis and what's going on in Black infant mortality. And so Earth is actually an app where you can see a hospital or a doctor review from somebody like you, right? So for me to read the review of a middle class, you know, a white woman, it may not be helpful to a low-income Black woman or a same-sex couple or to transgender folks. So what it allows you to do is go into the app, say exactly who you are in terms of your race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identification, your insurance type, you know, your income. And then it will help generate a review from someone most like you. And so I'm excited about this tool so that can, you know, we as women and all birthing folks can begin to create accountability within the hospital and medical profession around how people are treated. I strongly believe that bias-free care is something everyone deserves. And I think Earth is a tool for that. What we can do, what I'm most excited about Earth is that it becomes a tool for change, because once we have these collective stories, right? So they can dismiss my story, what happened to me. They may even dismiss what happened to Serena Williams, which is, you know, sad and tragic, and thank God she lived to tell us her story. But if we put all those stories together in one place, they can't dismiss us all. And so we now get to go back to these hospital systems and say, hey, funny thing, 80% of the Black women in our app, or 90% of the same-sex couples are saying XYZ about their care in your hospital, and now we can work to change it. And so I'm really excited about the potential for Earth as an accountability mechanism. I have been out actively seeking funding. So anyone in your audience wants to support us in making Earth a reality. I feel like we are very close, but always out there talking about it, trying to get people excited. You can learn more at birthwithoutbias.com. And I would, you know, really want people to get excited about this opportunity to make sure that bias-free care is a right for everybody. Also just wanting to mention, I mean, I say this every place I go, that Earth is also a tool for white women who consider themselves allies, because we need their stories in the app as well to help
you know, really illuminate any distinctions in care. And so it's also a tool for allies of marginalized groups to share their experiences and let that be part of the collective storytelling about now we're going to have this national repository of experiences of care around among marginalized groups. And I'm just real excited about its potential.
This is so gorgeous. I didn't know about this.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm so excited about this project. So if people go to birthwithoutbias.com, is there a way that they can get in, that they can just donate there? Is there a way that they can get in contact for like bigger ways to support the project?
Yes, there is a contact form. I think the donate form is actually officially on the nonprofit page, which is Narrative Nation, and the website is wewriteus.org. But there's certainly a link there on Birth Without Bias around that. And right now we've been, you know, kind of focused on foundation funding. What we need to do is to go into about 5 cities and do a deep review collection dive. You know, it needs density to work before we launch it nationally. So, you know, I'm excited about that opportunity, which kind of takes me back to the work I was doing in the Southeast, right? My community projects. So it's all kind of connected for me, but for us to try to get funded to kind of go into 5 or 6 cities, get, you know, get these, get the density of a few cities in the app and then launch it nationally for us to be able to now start to look for trends, start analyzing the data, and then go to hospital systems and start to work with them on instituting real change based on the lived experience, right? Based on what's actually happening in that. One of the things that people can do right now, if you are on birthwithoutbias.com, we've been kind of refining our collection tool, and it's more of a quick form survey right now, so it's not as fun as it will be in it on an app interface, but we've been really documenting and gathering experiences around what bias looks like. And so it's not really going to be that in earth you just tell your story in a free form, but you will be asked to specifically identify the experiences of bias, which can include everything from lack of eye contact to, you know, people entering your examination room without knocking first, bringing in strangers, et cetera, et cetera. So we really want to create not just a place for the free form review, but also for us to really tease out what bias looks like so that we can begin to specifically address these concerns in the care that, you know, people are receiving.
I feel like that kind of work is going to change the medical profession for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. That's for amazing. Sure. It's making me tear up. I'm so excited about it. Okay. We ask everybody at the end of an interview an easy light question. And I noticed on your social media there was a video of your daughter doing step dancing at Spelman College.
Yes.
What is that like to have a college, a child in college at a Black women's university? I mean,
oh my God, you know,
like,
it's so amazing. Now you're making me tear up and you literally just gave me goosebumps. I went to NYU for undergrad and Columbia for grad school. And, you know, to be honest, HBCUs, while, you know, having many great friends for something, were not necessarily on my radar. And my daughter was very clear, and she has attended many, you know, she's really only attended predominantly white schools, private schools. And she really wanted to be in a space where she wasn't different anymore. And I just loved that about her. And she led me in this journey. Obviously, I jumped right in line immediately, but I'm so incredibly proud of her. And when we talk about our children being our teachers, right? I mean, she continues to teach me. And just watching her unfold, one of the things that I love about Spelman, and once we visited after she was accepted, like, I got it immediately. You step on that campus and you're just like, you know, I was like, where do I sign? You know? And for me, the idea of leaving her in the hands of Black women, both historically, you know, just metaphorically and literally, was overwhelming for them to finish the work that, you know, young Black women need. And so that has just been the most amazing thing for me as a mother, to watch her in this profound space that is so unique. and to see what she's becoming as a result of it. I'm not going to cry, not going to cry, not going to cry. has just been a wonderful journey. And so Kayla, you know, she'll be upset that I say this, but, you know, like rhythm and dancing is not necessarily her strong suit, right? Like she gets the jokes in the family. So the fact that she took an area where she has probably been teased more by her little brother and turned that into something that she wanted to work on and display and represent her community and her school about was just phenomenal to me. And she practiced so hard. Like I was getting worried if you read my post, you should be practicing until, you know, early in the morning. And I was like, what are you doing? You know, what's going on down there? But it's just been a phenomenal experience and kind of going down there to support her. And of course she asked me to be present, which got me all excited. Cause when they still ask you to show up in college, you're like, yes, you know? And it was just amazing. And I'm so proud of her for kind of taking on such a serious commitment, for taking an area that may not have been her strong suit to coming out of her comfort zone. It was just so much more than what she did on the stage that just made me in awe of who she's becoming as a young woman. So it was great.
Oh, I love that. So we ask, what is your favorite part about parenting? So start with the most challenging and then your favorite part. Anything that comes up for you.
Yeah, I feel like the most challenging part is, you know, kind of believing in myself that I'm doing okay. You know, after my divorce, I became particularly, you know, just worried as a single parent. One of the things that was really important for me was that my children did not see themselves as statistics, right? Like, you know, this is not defining us in terms of you being now from a single parent home. So my ex-husband moved back to London. So it really was a very abnormal co-parenting situation where I was literally, you know, physically left by myself in the country. And so, you know, that part just kind of allowing myself to be like, okay, they're doing okay. And even when Kayla, you know, went to college, it took a lot of my friends because I'm still worried. I got to get her out and I got to do this. And they were like, have a moment to be proud of yourself that you've got to this milestone. So that's been the challenge. You know, the joy is just everything that I learned from my children. You know, everything that there is obviously just watching them grow. My son just got accepted to this engineering academy. So he's going to be at Princeton for a month living on campus this summer, and just watching him go through that process and doing interviews and getting recommendation letters and seeing him at 15 be this amazing young Black male is just a great sense of joy for me. So watching my children develop and seeing what I'm still learning from them is a great joy for me. And I continue to find joy on that journey. So I'm excited about that.
Oh, thank you so much. Beautiful. This has been a wonderful experience for us. And we're going to have all these websites that we talked about will be on our website. We'll link everything up. And in general, you can go to KimberlySealsHours.com.
So nice to virtually meet you. And this has been an incredible conversation. Thank you for taking the time.
And again, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Wash Your Mouth Out podcast. You can find us on the web at washyourmouthoutpodcast.com. Come follow us on Instagram at Wash Your Mouth Out podcast and on Twitter at Mouth Out podcast.
Wash your mouth out. Wash your mouth out. Hey, Maria.
Yeah, Madison.
Are you gonna go wash your mouth out?
With soap.
So dirty.
Dirty parents.
Dirty, dirty. Hey, Maria. I think I have to go.
Go what?
I have to go and wash my mouth out.
Hey, we know you want to get funky with yourself. Go check out academyofburlesque.online and don't forget your coupon code SOAP.
Soap!